This is the Urban Astronomer Podcast. Hello, and welcome to episode 28 of the Urban Astronomer Podcast. Man, it is good to be back, and thank you for your patience. I know you've waited a while for this episode. Here it is. Actually, tonight I was supposed to be sitting in the town of Mahikeng in the northwest province of South Africa. I was invited to run a stand at an exhibition around a major event where Northwest University are launching a new public telescope. It was supposed to be a huge event. Press were going to be there. The Minister of Science and Technology was supposed to do the ribbon cutting, and various exhibitors from around the country were going to run stands. There were going to be portable planetariums. It was going to be great. And I was supposed to represent the Astronomical Society of South Africa and, of course, this podcast. And the day before we were supposed to leave, a message came out that the show had been cancelled. As it turns out, there's been a lot of unrest in the area over the last week or so. It's to do with, if I read in the news correctly, politicians who have been exposed as being enormously corrupt and general unhappiness with the citizenry that the governing party has not recalled the premier who was responsible, and well, they're unhappy. Vehicles have been torched, fires set in the streets, airports have been shut down, neighboring countries have shut down the border posts on that city. It's quite a big deal. So I hope it all gets sorted out soon. I hope that the problems get resolved and that we get to do our opening. Meanwhile, a couple of weeks back, a month or two ago, at the symposium, or the Astronomical Society Symposium, I presented a talk on podcasting and how it can be used to engage users for citizen science projects and just how to do outreach in astronomy. And after the talk, the director of the American Association of Variable Star Observers approached me to ask if she could please appear on the show to promote the AAVSO, which was an enormous relief for me because I've been planning to approach her after her excellent talks. And I was a little bit starstruck, if I'm honest. I didn't know how to approach her. So thank you, Stella. She has made this a lot easier for me, and it means I get to bring to you Dr. Stella Kafka.
Okay, so my name is Stella Kafka. I am the executive director of the American Association of Variable Star Observers. And the reason why I'm saying that you have to define hometown for me is because I was born in one place, I live in another, but in general, I am a citizen of the world. So I would consider that the Earth is our oyster. So, and this actually fits with my function here at the AVSO, considering how international we are. We're working with everyone in principle. So yeah. I was born and raised in Greece. And by means of many, many different places, I ended up in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Okay. Did you always, as a kid, did you like the stars? Were you a big fan of astronomy? Is it something that you grew into later?
This is something that came out organically for me. I grew up in a big city. And as many people who live in a city know, it's really difficult to even see stars from there. I mean, you could see the sun, the moon, and some planets maybe when the weather was good or clear from downtown Athens where I grew up from. I came in astronomy from a physics point. I always wanted to break things, build things, try to understand how things work. And when it comes to stars, this is a place where you can't break anything. It's kind of safe, right? And you're not endangering anyone by doing so. But actually, it's a natural curiosity if you want to actually see what's around you. It's part of nature, right? And it's part of a big picture of nature, as in we live on a tiny little planet, around a tiny little star, in a tiny little neighborhood. So what's out there and how does it work? So since I could not dissect stars, I decided to become an astronomer through physics, through trying to understand the world around me. And I haven't looked back since. It's a fascinating vocation. It's a fascinating trip. It's a fascinating subject matter. And I'm working with fantastic people trying to actually solve some of its mysteries. So It's true that astronomy is not actually a profession that pays, but at the same time, it's something that you can do even if you're not a professional astronomer, even if you don't have a degree. And this is what the AVSO is all about, right? This is what this organization was built on, and this is what it has to offer to anyone who joins it at any level they want to join. So I hear that from many people, actually, that, I wish I could become an astronomer. I always liked the universe, and I always liked trying to read about astronomy, about planets, about stars, about galaxies, about the Big Bang and about black hole physics, et cetera, et cetera. And the AVA is actually enabling people who always had a dream to become an astronomer to actually become an astronomer, be part of a scientific discovery, not just looking at pretty pictures and beautiful objects, but also taking data, analyzing data, discussing the processes behind how things work and why they work the way they work. We're trying to understand the world around us. We're natural explorers. That's exactly what it is that we're doing here. And we're doing it with our planet, and through astronomy, we're doing it for other worlds.
Yeah.
So it's really exciting. It's really fun.
What is your research interest? I mean, before you came to AAVSO, what were you looking at?
I was looking at explosions. I was looking at stars that are cannibalizing their companion. And actually, before I came at the AVSO, I was using AVSO data to even get my thesis. So in principle, I am a daughter of the AVSO. It came out of this organization. I used data from this organization. Without the data from observers all over the world on the objects I was studying, my thesis, my degree would not have been possible. And this is a sentiment I'm sharing with many professional astronomers. And I think that this is something that our observers don't understand, don't realize that how valuable their data are. So I study what we call cataclysmic variables, which are binary star systems that are very, very close together. They consist of a star that is more or less the mass of our sun, maybe a little bit less massive, and a companion that is a white dwarf. A white dwarf is a star that is as dense as the sun, as massive as the sun, and as big as the Earth. So just imagine how dense it is, super dense. Mm-hmm. So if you put these two stars together, very close together, in a distance that is less than the radius of the sun, for example, then the white dwarf, because of its huge density and its huge gravitational field, will start sucking the light out of its companion. So it's just eating its outer layers. These are the types of stars that I am studying. The reason why they're called cataclysmic is because there are phenomena that are happening because of this mass transfer from one star to another that are violent. Those stars show outbursts, they show material ejections, or show outflows, they show nova eruptions. If you believe some of the models that are there, the white dwarf in some of those stars can become a supernova, actually a supernova type 1A, one of the most valuable ones for cosmological and distance purposes. So they're really very important. Or it is really very important to understand processes that are happening in their atmospheres, and actually especially how this mass is transferred from star A to star B. Stellar cannibalism and this kind of accretion events are happening in many, many different parts of nature. So cataclysmic variables are very valuable to understand stellar accretion simply because there are many of them and they're relatively nearby and not obscured by dust.
Mm-hmm.
So. Scientifically, that's what I'm interested in. And I'm approaching those objects both from the photometry point, where you actually monitor the light variations from the star by taking picture after picture after picture, or observation after observation after observation, and seeing how they change, to spectroscopy, which is pretty much a glorified term that is used to the method that we're using by stretching stellar light. So it's very similar to what you do when light goes through a prism. It analyzes all the light in all these colors.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exactly what we do with a big telescope, but using something a little bit more sophisticated and way, way more expensive than a prism.
Right, right. Yes, I remember there were a few talks about that at the symposium, and I'm pretty sure they're going to be on YouTube at some point, but I also know how long it takes to edit these things, so we'll put a link up when that happens. But yeah, okay, so AAVSO, what is that exactly?
AAPSO is an organization that was founded at the Harvard Observatory in 1911 by a group of amateur astronomers who were pretty much engaged in scientific projects that had to do with variable stars, stars whose brightness is changing within a night or a week or a month. The AAPSO started as an organization that was providing what we call finding charts, meaning star charts that were showing a star of interest, the variable star, and stars that one could use in order to compare the star's brightness, the variable star's brightness, with, in order to assess how bright it is. You have to remember, something is variable, something is changing with respect to something else that is not changing, right? And it's the same thing in our everyday life. People are changing with respect to how they were 3 days ago, or 3 months ago, or 3 years ago. So those stars are changing with time with respect to how bright or how they were behaving 10 years ago, 100 years ago, even, you know, thousands of years ago. But we know their variations only through records of those variations for the last maybe couple hundred of years. So in the grand scheme of things, variable star astronomy, or the way that we do it, is relatively new. So it's kind of a relatively recent recent profession. Having said that, you know, I was looking at archives and all kinds of manuscripts trying to find when the first variable star observation was officially recorded, other than novae and supernovae that are like a one-off event, like a bright dot. And apparently there is a small snippet from the Cairo calendar 3,000 years ago that was talking about Algol, which is an eclipsing binary. Yeah. And they were mentioning that Algol is a binary with a period of 2.8 days. Isn't that fascinating? 3,000 years ago, ancient Egyptians knew that Algol is a star whose brightness is changing, and they derived a period of 2.8 days.
I thought you were going to say Myra, because that's the one that you classically always learn about as, you know, this well-known, in antiquity, named for being variable. Yeah, there's Egyptians.
Well, I'm pretty sure you can also find some Persian manuscripts somewhere. Babylonians had some kind. So these are stars. I mean, the night sky was very frequently observed by those who had their hands dirty with agriculture. They needed to know seasons. They needed to know tides. They needed to know where they were. Those who were interested in navigation, because they needed to know where they were here on Earth, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They were navigating by stars. So I'm pretty sure there are lots of historical documents that are talking about the historical aspect of those stars. And I'm pretty sure that there's some kind of aspects of verbal stories that were not necessarily passed intact from generation to generation, but they do talk about stars whose brightness is changing. I wish there was a way of actually collecting those everywhere.
It's got me thinking of the sort of South Sea navigation traditions, which, of course, I only knew about after my kids started watching that film Moana, you know, which they demonstrated so well. Actually, it wasn't just made up for the cartoon, but that was all oral traditions, wasn't it? So they'll probably never know.
You have to remember Polynesians somehow navigated was it the Pacific?
Yeah, enormous distances, Hawaii to New Zealand to...
everywhere.
It's amazing.
But they had to do it somehow. They were not exactly moving blind. I don't think so. At least they knew whether they were going north or west.
Well, no, I understand that when you see what they're doing in the film, holding their hands up in different angles, that was the actual methods they used to find latitude and what have you. So,
I mean, Pixar got it right. I really like Pixar movies. They're really fun. They really are.
So then AAPSO, is that, I think of it as an amateur-driven, amateur organization. Is that the case? Has it always been that way?
This, actually, that's not the case. This is an organization that was always a professional slash amateur collaboration.
Okay.
And we have to clarify here, right? Amateur can mean something different for different cultures and different nomenclatures. So amateur, in principle, is somebody who loves what they're doing. right? It comes from the French word amour. So it's not a novice or a person who is unprofessional or a person who is ignorant. It's a person who loves what they're doing. So most people who actually went and gotten a degree in astronomy are amateurs in astronomy, amateurs of astronomy. They are lovers of astronomy. They love what they're doing. So the AVSO from its beginning was an organization that brought those worlds together. I mean, somebody had to actually showcase stars that are interesting for scientific projects, and somebody else would have to take data for them, and then someone else would actually have to help with interpretation. And but when the AVSO started as an organization here in the United States, it started, even it had an international component. So we had a member amongst the 11 first members of the AAVSO, so we had a member from Italy. So there was okay. somebody who was the international component, let's say. It was adopted as an organization of individuals who were taking data for specific projects. So we were very specific in our mission. We're very specific in our goals. We were working on variable stars, stars whose brightness is changing. It had nothing to do with big galaxies or sketching galaxies or taking pictures of nebulae, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So if not anything else, in the grand scheme of things, at an era where organizations or amateur astronomy clubs were coming to being, the AVSO was defined from the very beginning as very science-oriented, very science-focused, and very international, and very pro-am. So anyone who was interested in understanding some aspect of stellar variability and doing some kind of work on it, acquiring data, reducing data, or understanding, were very welcome at the AVSO. So fast forward 107 years, here we are as an international organization who is enabling pretty much anyone, anywhere to participate in scientific discovery through variable star astronomy. That is our mission. Through that mission, we're providing all kinds of training material to help people actually be part of that. We are providing discussions, interactions with people, a database that is being curated by our observers. Members come from both professional and non-professional career paths in astronomy, career paths. And we just have an international organization. We are an international organization that in principle has no borders. As long as you're interested in discussing aspects of some of the most dynamic and crazy phenomena in the universe with your peers, you are treated equally. The only borders that we put is rules of engagement, in principle. As long as you are willing to discuss this kind of subjects in a respectful manner, then you're very welcome to contribute and join us. And we are trying to actually provide you with the means you might need in order to be engaged in this organization the way that you feel comfortable or interested in.
So if someone wants to do that... Mm-hmm. I'm thinking because as amateurs, you know, there's all levels of skill and available time and equipment. There's someone like me who's got decent equipment and very little time, and there's people with all the time in the world and no equipment. And, of course, all the old retired guys that make up most of the clubs, you know, who've got both. Is there space for everyone in that, or what is the requirement?
There's no requirement. There's place for anyone. This is not a business contract where you have to provide a specific amount of data every week or something.
Right.
There's no, in principle, the only requirement is that you're interested and that you join us. If you have time to be a very active observer and go out every clear night and take data, you should do that because clear nights are really very precious. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that from a person who lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we haven't had a clear night since forever. All dark nights are very precious. And again, from a person who lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and has her next door neighbor shining big spotlights through her window, it's a very light polluted area. if you're interested in helping with data quality control, so you don't have a telescope and you're not really interested in fighting mosquitoes outside your door, but you would like to be part of this organization, you can actually do that. You can be engaged in other ways as well, data analysis or software improvement, or pretty much just quote-unquote participating in the discussion. You can be part of the AVSO at any level you feel comfortable, and at any level you have time to do. It's the same thing as most good hobbies. They don't expect you to be a pro in order to follow them. So any data set is very valuable. Any data discussion is super interesting. And anyone is very welcome to join us at any level of comfort or time or availability.
Okay, that's interesting.
Well, think about it. You are a young professional. You have a full-time job and a full-time family and a full-time equipment. So maybe what you have in your hands as an observer is perhaps one day a week or 2 days a month where you can actually go and take data. But just think about it this way. Maybe the stars that you're studying, because the stars that you're studying are so variable, maybe the data that you take are the only data that are acquired on those stars those nights. And those data sets can actually help us understand a behavior of those stars down the road that is not recorded by anyone else. We are building a database here. Those things are doing something unexpected, and you have to put it in perspective in order to be able to understand it.
So if I'm only capturing a very few observations, it's still going together with other observers, and it's being combined.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's super valuable. That's the strength of the AVA. So is it in the woman and manpower that it attracts to actually enrich this database? There are many very, very exciting objects, but sometimes we realize how exciting, how cool they are after a specific amount of data is being gathered. We don't realize how high interesting they are until we start seeing variations that, you know, shouldn't be there otherwise. So there's something else going on with them. There's something else that is sparking those variations. And this is something that can be captured only when enough data has been accumulated on the stars. And just imagine, even if we have like a million observers, there are billions of stars out in the night sky. There's not enough time. Every data point is valuable.
Something you mentioned when you were speaking at the ESA Symposium a few weeks ago, you mentioned, I've forgotten which one, I think it was Kepler, a survey mission which showed that all stars are variable. And I know you went into this at the talk, but what does that mean then for this kind of observation?
So we learned two things from Kepler, that to Kepler's accuracy, and you have to remember, Kepler is a space-based telescope that can look at things very, very accurately in a way that we cannot do that from the ground. So to Kepler's accuracy, every single star has some variations in its light curve. Something is happening. And those variations can be tiny, very small, that you can't see them from the ground, or large, that you can actually see them from the ground, but because we haven't had enough data, those changes have been ignored. Or we didn't even know that they existed, right? So what Kepler did was it was pointing at the same part of the sky nonstop, the space telescope, 24-hour coverage, 365 days a year for 4 years in a row. So a very specific time period. 4 years is not a very long time. A very specific time period observing a specific amount of stars. Another result of citizen scientists who actually went to the citizen science project that Kepler actually launched after the spacecraft went to do something else, there were lots of super interesting phenomena that were recovered of stars that we just didn't know that they existed, like Tabby's star, for example, the crazy star with the dips in its light curve.
Oh, yes, and then suddenly, the Ringwald star, yeah.
the alien megastructures. Where, you know, okay, great. So we have this fantastic data set of 4 years in a row and those variations. And now what? the spacecraft went and done something else. We can't exactly put it back to the to look at that particular star. How are we going to understand what's going on? I mean, how are we going to even figure out why those dips exist? This is where non-professional observers are saving the day. And even now, this is a very active object of observations, a very active discussion subject. So this, if not anything else, Kepler demonstrated that even if you have a space-based telescope pointing at the same part of the night sky for a time period, what it's going to do is going is it's going to point you to interesting targets. It's not going to solve anything. It's going to actually showcase, if not anything else, that objects that have been neglected or we didn't know of can show unpredictable behaviors and point to all kinds of new stars to observe for those who have the time and the energy to do such observations. And of course, cause a lot of headaches to professional astronomers, but that's a different story. we all deal with our professional headaches. So we're talking about the era of big surveys, right? Everyone who is anyone at this point is designing a survey to look at the entire night sky and look at every single object that exists in there. Not only stars, they're looking at galaxies. They're interested in supernovae, right? Supernova explosion. But exactly because you're looking at the entire sky, unless if you have a lattice of satellites around the Earth that are observing at every single part of the sky nonstop, there are gaps in the data. And no survey lasts for more than 2 or 3 years.
Right.
So the gaps in the data may be dictated by the fact that you don't observe the same star nonstop, especially here from Earth, right? You don't observe the same star nonstop. You're looking at different parts of the night sky, even during the night. So there are breaks in the cadence. You may be looking at doing your survey and looked at the same part of the night sky in one or two filters, which is not giving you the full story of what's going on. If you are here on Earth, do you know of any place here on Earth that has 365 nights a year of clear skies? So you will have gaps because of weather, right?
Yeah.
And because we're looking only at the part of the sky that is dark, we can't look through the sun, there are seasonal gaps as well, because our stars are getting, or we're getting on the other side of the sun, the stars are covered by the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So you will never have this kind of coverage from any of the surveys. There are going to be gaps. And somebody needs to cover those gaps in order to actually do decent science. Even TESS, which is the next satellite that is going to be monitoring parts of the sky, has a cadence of a month. So it's going to be monitoring a specific part of the sky for a month.
Mm-hmm.
And then what?
Right.
Right?
Right.
And TESS is meant to be doing this kind of work for 2 years. No one knows what's going to happen afterwards. Everything depends on funding. But, you know, if you have a beautiful light curve of an object for a month that is showing you something crazy, and then your favorite observatory is doing something else, pointing at something else, it's like you're trying to read a book and you're in the middle and somebody's taking the book away from you.
Yeah.
And you're at the most exciting part of your book. You're climaxing when it comes to a discovery or somebody's trying to open the door and then the book is taken away from you. No, you really need to actually see what's happening next.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what we're doing when it comes to science, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those surveys are going to help us with our understanding of some aspect of the night sky. But what we really need to understand as non-professional astronomers and as people who are interested in understanding how those stars are behaving long-term and short-term is that we really need to put those surveys in perspective. It's like you have someone dedicated to observing a specific type of object for a specific time period. Plus, more to that point, those surveys have specific goals. They can't be doing everything. They really cannot. And stellar variability usually is not their primary goal. Or the stellar variability that we live and study, as in stars that are changing in brightness.
Hmm.
Some of those surveys are interested, most of the surveys are interested in exoplanets. So stars that have rocks around them and they show brightness variations because you have a rock that is actually stealing some of its stars. So it's a mini eclipse in principle.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the case of LSST, which is a different sort of survey, they're interested in dark energy. So they're interested in supernovae only. variable stars and stellar variability is a side product of those surveys. And what that means is that they were not designed to do variable stars.
Okay.
So that makes the data that are acquired on variable stars even more incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
So if not anything else, the take-home message here is that because of all those surveys, we live in a golden era of variable star astronomy. We're going to learn more than we want to know about variable stars, but what we're going to end up with is data sets that are so incomplete that are going to be frustrating. Frustrating in the sense that, again, you're looking just at the part of the story. You can't build a whole puzzle, and essential parts of the puzzle are missing. And you can't exactly put them together unless you have more data. So we need as many observers and as many observations as possible. There are not enough professional telescopes to do this kind of follow-ups.
Right.
Actually, there are no professional telescopes to do this kind of follow-ups. Only non-professional observers will do it.
Hmm.
I'm convinced about that.
I suppose until such time as there are enough telescopes to cover the entire sky. And that means amateurs, right?
Exactly. The strength of the AVSO, so the strength of everyone who has any means of observations. And we're talking about telescopes, right? But a DSLR camera can surprise.
Yeah.
The strength of that is that there are many of them and there are different places, right? So when somebody is clouded out or has instrument problems or you just can't go out and observe, someone else may be observing.
Mm. How long have you been director of AAVSO?
Officially, I started February 1st of 2015. Mm. So a little bit more than 3 years now.
Okay. How'd you get a job like that?
I applied for it. So there are two different ways that you can see of it. One of you can talk about it. One is as simple as that, right? Yeah. I send my resume and they say, oh my gosh, we found our next gem. And the second way is that you send your resume and then you go through 2, 3, 4 cycles of interviews and questions and all kinds of stuff. You are fortunate to be chosen for this particular position. It's an interesting way of assessing which is the right person for a position, and I see it as necessary as it's a two-way kind of compatibility assessment, right? So you are being questioned on whether you are appropriate for that position, but at the same time, you're questioning your interviewees, your interviewers on whether this position is appropriate for you. It has to be a two-way relationship. Otherwise, one of the two is not happy.
I was curious then, is this a exclusive role that you have? Are you still actively researching?
I haven't been able to do as much research as I wanted to over the last 3 years, especially because the AVSO right now is going through a self-identification. We're doing a lot of things for our community. We have been doing for a lot of things for the last 100 years, and it's time for us to take a critical step back and see what we're doing well and how we're going to strengthen the AAVSO for our members and our observers. The world has changed over the last 100 years. Gosh, I dare say the world has changed over the last 15 years, even in the way that we communicate with each other, the way that data are pouring in or out, the way that we are perceiving each other through social media and through all kinds of other communication avenues. So, and the AAVSO as an organization needs to grow and follow whatever trends and whatever directions our observers are taking us. There are new opportunities for growth for the organization. There are new opportunities for our observers to grow through really exciting projects. We have moved very aggressively towards exoplanet observations, so training our observers to observe exoplanets and support missions such as TESS, and who knows what's going to be there after TESS. Or Plato from the European point, which is actually the European version of TESS. And we need to move towards spectroscopy. Our observers are capable at this point of, in terms of equipment, to observe spectroscopically. So we really need to engage them in projects like that. So what that means is the organization that started us creating finding charts and continued developing a database for variable object archiving, data archiving, has to actually move with wherever the science is taking it in order to be relevant, in order to serve its community. And this is what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very interesting place to be, to actually overviewing the organization, and, taking a step back to appreciate how it started and where it is right now. It's very interesting.
Okay. How's it changed since you took over?
It has changed. And you know something? If it hadn't changed, then it would be my fault. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I took over only 3 years ago. So for an organization like that to showcase more change will take a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
We are getting a little bit more organized. We are we're tightening a little bit our program. We are improving our infrastructure, and we are engaging as many volunteers as possible in our work. We're tapping a lot on people's expertise, and we're discovering that we work with a very enthusiastic group of observers and members whom I really love meeting in person. And we're listening a lot, as in what people need, how people work, how they believe that the organization will serve them better. So, And of course, you know, from the professional community, you look at how astronomy is changing, where we're trying to actually foster as many collaborations as possible with big collaborations with big projects such as TESS and BRIGHT and LSST and you know what, while keeping existing projects here. So we're trying to bring really exciting projects to our observers and get them a little bit more involved in those as well, if they choose to do so. So I want to believe that the organization hasn't even started changing the way I would like it to yet, considering that I would like it to be a little bit more prominent and more known. For some reason, we're not very well known in the community. And that's a pity, because that actually translates to missed opportunities. So that is one of the efforts that I'm making. And I would like to see it more diversified. I want to see it more diverse. We're talking, we want to engage anyone, anywhere. What that means is that we really need to reach out to minorities a little bit more and provide at least the opportunity to be engaged with us. And I think that this is the reason, one of the reasons why we haven't done so is because we're not known to them. So reaching out just to inform all communities of who we are, what we can offer to them, is one of our priorities.
Okay. For what it's worth, I think I've known about the organization since I first started observing properly as a young teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Although it was always this very, how do you call it, out of reach, very, you know, this is what's advanced grown-ups were doing. I think it's not
advanced grown-ups.
Well, I was very young when I first heard about it, and that impression sort of never changed, you know. So it was, I think, a great thing about meeting you, at least, is it it sort of humanized it, you know, meant that you don't have to be this high dedicated all the time, all the equipment, all the training, you know, cream of the amateur crop. To participate.
You're right. And there is this kind of misconception amongst everyone in principle, not necessarily the non-professional astronomy club, the amateur astronomy clubs, that in order to do anything in astronomy, you really need to invest a lot in terms of money and time.
Mm-hmm.
So the entry point is really high, and it's really inaccessible for those who are who can't afford it. So it's a hobby, it's a profession, it's a function just for the few and lucky ones who have already solved all their financial problems, and now they're looking for an expensive hobby.
Mm-hmm.
Astronomy and variable star astronomy can be as cheap, quote unquote, as using your eyes to estimate brightness changes. And actually, one of the really exciting talks that the ASA Symposium invited was Magda Stoll, where she was talking about looking through her telescope and sketching parts of what she was saying. Absolutely fascinating. So you don't really need to invest $1,000 worth of equipment in order to actually do this kind of work. I have a pair of binoculars. That's all I have. Mm-hmm. For my own observing work, right? I started as a visual astronomer 2 years ago. And I wish I had more time and better skies, actually, to go out every other night and look at the night sky and do my visual estimates. And the cool thing is that I have submitted some observations in our database. And from time to actually every week, I'm getting a report that's generated when people are looking at my observations, download them for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And it's really very rewarding, although I haven't observed for a while now, to actually see that my data are being downloaded and used. Maybe a quick lookup of a light curve. Somebody is trying to actually do an observing program for their telescope or their class or their own interest and just wanted to look at the data or download the data for a study. Mm-hmm. And perhaps my data will appear in a scientific manuscript at some point. The AVSO is providing all entry points that are necessary. We provide the manuals. If you are a person who is going to sit down and read a document and try to do it yourself, we provide a help desk. You can actually send us an email and ask one way or another. We'll be happy to help you continue your program. Provide online seminars. If you want to take and learn a seminar and learn a technique on how to do that, we have a wonderful peer mentoring program. And actually, I would like to invite your more experienced observers to join that program because it helps novice observers to actually learn by doing and by having someone to discuss different aspects of their observing practice. So that is pretty much what I would like to shake off with you, if possible. Mm-hmm. This impression that you really need to be a millionaire in order to actually do astronomy. You don't.
That's and in something principle, we keep telling each other. You know, it's whenever we ask each other for advice, no, you need the better equipment. You need to go travel into... And it's not where the fun is.
It's not where the fun is, and not everybody can travel in the darkest part of the world. And actually, if not anything else, one thing that you guys have in South Africa that we don't in the rest of the world is still dark skies. Really good dark skies. Even if, you know, your sky is not completely dark, like you can't reach your six-minded stars, you can definitely see your fifth. And here, variable star astronomy can't happen when you have some light pollution. It cannot happen from the center of Boston. It cannot happen from the center of Athens, Greece. It cannot happen from the center of New York City, especially when you have spotlights moving around. But it can happen from the outskirts of Johannesburg, and it can happen from Cape Town, and it can happen from any other part of South Africa. So, and actually, any other part of Africa. There are lots of really good skies that you guys have.
Yeah, this sounds like it really does sound like it's like something it's worth. Man, we should be doing this. Should really be doing
this.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, you should be doing this.
Okay. So then, tell me if people listening now we've sold them. How can they get hold of you? What must they do? How can they get started?
AVSO@AVSO.org. Go to our webpage. There's so much material in there. If you need more directions, just send us an email. It's as simple as that.
Okay, great. I'll put a link up on the page.
That sounds great.
Great, thank you. Okay, so next episode, I will begin a new series talking about astrophysics. A listener wrote in and requested specifically to learn a little bit more about how the universe works, some of the science behind the astronomy, the people I interview, the stuff they're actually doing, how does it work? And you know what? Andrew, I think I will do this. Thank you for the request. And I think from next week, I'm going to begin talking about supernovae. And I'm going to break this down into very small digestible portions. I think it's going to be, well, it's a topic that's familiar to most people with an interest in astronomy. But I'm hoping to approach it in maybe a different way from the way you've heard it to give you a different understanding. Until then, cheerio and clear skies.